Hello and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 136. My name is Terry Frost, and as you can tell from the music, I am diving back into Bond mania. Rather than doing any of the obvious things, what I thought I'd do this time around is look at the two Bond films that starred Timothy Dalton, 1987's The Living Daylights and 1989's License to Kill. I think there's a lot to say about Dalton's time as Bond, and I'm going to say it. So sit back, relax, I'll get the contact details out of the way, and we'll get on with the show. Paleo Cinema Podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of classic film appreciation. The rules are simple and two in number. Firstly, the movie has to be more than 20 years old, and secondly, I have to like it. Feedback is very important, so you can leave reviews on iTunes. You can email me at cultguru@gmail.com, that's cult with a K. Or you can head over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. You can like the page there and add your 2 cents worth. Now, this podcast contains adult language and concepts, so enjoy it. Okay, so how is everybody? We're doing fine here. Next weekend, I'm heading off to the National Science Fiction Convention here in Melbourne, Continuum 10. And I'm doing a couple of panels on that one, about which is going to be about silent science fiction films from the silent movie era, and I just dropped something there. And the other one is going to be about how to do a podcast, something about which I know very little. And I'm going to enjoy it. I'm spending an entire 3.5 days there, which should be fun, catching up with people. So if you're turning up at Continuum, say hi. I will have a few Paleo Cinema fridge magnets and things like that there, and I'll be handing them out with embarrassing profligacy. So I'm really looking forward to that. It'll be a nice little buzz for me. I'm going bachelor this time. Sal's not coming with me. She's got her own stuff to do on the weekend. And I'm just going to catch up with a few people and really enjoy myself. So what have I been watching? I've been watching a fair bit, really. There's a lot of good stuff here. I'm not sure where I stopped last time, which is problematic. Let me just see if I can figure it out with my own little brain here. I did see Mononc, the Jacques Tati movie. I rewatched that to have a chat with Liz Travascus on ABC local radio in Darwin and enjoyed that a lot. Nice French comedy. The interesting thing is that both Liz and I watched it without the subtitles this time. And you lose nothing by watching it without the subtitles. It's all in the physicality and in the sight gags and in the physical comedy of Jacques Tati, which was kind of cool to do as an intellectual exercise. I mean, with my French lessons, I did pick up a few of the words that's spoken. I'm still not getting full sentences in a lot of cases, but I'm picking up enough of the individual words that I can usually pass out what's being said in, 40% of the cases. So, work in progress there. I did see an action flick, Jack Ryan Shadow Recruit, starring Chris Pine, directed by and also starring Kenneth Branagh. It's an action flick. It's a spy flick. Brenner's very good in it. I'm not sure Chris Pine's fantastic in it. Jack Ryan always struck me as a very generic, white, privileged American kind of character. Not a lot of texture and nuance there. So can't really expect too much of it. But there are some nice action sequences there just to keep people from getting out of their seats and going and standing outside. But, so I did watch that, which was, neither good nor bad, but somewhere kind of in the middle there. I'll leave aside the genre films I watched. I've watched a fair few of those lately. I'll leave those to have a chat at Martian Drive-In Time about. But I did see a documentary on the Warner Brothers called The Brothers Warner, which goes into the history of Warner Brothers Studios and Warner Brothers as a family and how they fucked each other over and did all sorts of nasty bits of business, and how they came up from the usual Jewish immigrant story at the turn of the 20th century to running a large and successful, overall successful movie studio. So that was good to get the historic context there and to show how even brothers can knife each other in the back. I revisited some fun stuff too, one of which was Rudy Ray Moore's The Human Tornado, the sequel to Dolomite. If you haven't seen Dolomite and The Human Tornado and Disco Godfather and Petey Wheatstraw, The Devil's Son-in-Law, you really should visit those. They're kind of blaxploitation done cheap with Rudy Ray Moore, who was a comic who worked blue, as they used to say in those days. And, yeah, they're a bit of fun, and they're not to be taken seriously at all, and a little bit of entertainment. And I watched a documentary about Rudy Ray Moore and his career in movies called The Legend of Dolomite, which came with all the other Dolomite movies. And I recommend that as well. So they were, you know, just nice going back into the kind of trashy low end of things. Now, I did watch, again, From Russia with Love, second of the James Bond films, starring Sean Connery, of course, with Lottie Lanier in it and Robert Shaw and various other people. Vladek Shabal's in it as well, playing Kronstein. And, yeah, that was good. That's the James Bond film, I think, that really does stay closest to the books. So I enjoyed revisiting that, which I do every couple of years just for the fun of it and to enjoy the way that plot holds together too, which is another really nice piece of work, and it was good to revisit that. I've seen three other films too, which I'll mention. First one was Lovelace, the kind of biopic of Linda Lovelace's life and career. I think it's neither good nor bad, but it's somewhere in the middle there. Some of the acting is good. James Franco kind of catches the check playing Hugh Hefner in it. Amanda Seyfried is very good as Lovelace herself. And Peter Sarsgaard's in there playing trainer and doing the full cocaine and craziness thing happening there. Got a couple of other interesting little bits in there with Hank Azaria playing Jerry Damiano, who directed the movie, and Chris Noth's in there and a few other people like that. So it's not without interest, but really it's one of those subjects that kind of almost demands a very rough and very uncompromising view of what's going on, and you don't get that from this film. Now, I did see Park Chan-wook's Stoker, starring Mia Wasikowska and Nicole Kidman and Matthew Good. It's an interesting film, very dark, and it's got a lot of resonances to Hitchcock movies, particularly Shadow of Doubt and things like that. And, very dark and interesting film. The funny thing I found about it is that all of the four main characters, Mia Wasikowska, Nicole Kidman, Jackie Weaver, and Matthew Good, none of them are Americans, even though they're playing American characters. The three women in the movie are all Australian, and Matthew Good's English. So it gives you that kind of slight strangeness about it, which adds to what's essentially a very Southern Gothic kind of story. And it's worth seeing. It doesn't have a fast pace to it. It's very measured, and there's a lot of symbolism and nuance in there, and some very, very creepy sequences. And worth checking out. I may have to watch that one again to really get the full appreciation of it. The other thing I've watched is The Wolf of Wall Street, Scorsese's movie starring Leonardo DiCaprio, Jonah Hill, and interesting people like Rob Reiner in it, for instance. Yeah, that one is totally fucking crazy. I think it's a good film. I think DiCaprio's good in it, though. I still have a bit of a dislike for DiCaprio for some reason. I'm not sure why. I think he's a good actor at what he does, but he's not an actor that I've warmed to. He's not an actor that you can kind of go, yeah, I really like him. So, it's one of those ones which is incredibly misogynistic because the characters were incredibly misogynistic. I'm not sure. And there's a comeuppance, of course, as the story goes on with Jordan Belfort tangles with the police and doesn't come off better for it. But it's a very long movie too. I don't know whether it should have been a little bit shorter. And Scorsese does do a fantastic job as a director. He breaks the fourth wall right from the start and never really gives you an objective view of anything all the way through the movie. It's worth seeing. I did enjoy it, but there was a stage where I thought, well, you know, just arrest the guy, you FBI guys. He's being a self-indulgent wanker again. And there's that kind of repetition of his wankery and some very strange and crazy sequences, particularly the one on the boat, which go to show you that even at his advanced years, Scorsese really does know how to surprise us in his movie making, which I think is really, really great. I hate people who, as they get older, kind of diminish. And I don't think the Scorsese's done that one tiny bit with this film. A lot of the film was improvised, I've been told. And it does really work well. And, yeah, check it out. So that's about it for what I've been watching. I'm going to take a break now, grab a bite to eat. And when I get back, we're going to look at The Living Daylights, the first of the two James Bond films that Timothy Dalton starred in.
I have here secret directive from Pushkin, Smirtspionam.
Death to spies, Minister.
We have to nip Smirtspionam in the bud. Pushkin should be in 10 years in 2 days' time. A termination warrant has been issued for him.
Our paths have crossed over the years. He's tough and resourceful. I can't believe he's a psychotic.
Neither did I until today. This arrived at Gibraltar. It was found near 004's body.
Don't make any sudden moves, General.
I take it that this is not a social call, 007.
Correct.
May I ask why?
Smirtspionam.
It was deactivated 20 years ago.
Two of our agents are dead. Koskov's named you.
We've convinced the British that Pushkin is a danger. They will send a best man, James Bond, to eliminate him.
Kara Milovi, talented scholarship cellist, whose arm was injured in a minor accident during an intermission last week.
You missed, deliberately.
Why are you trying to help me?
I had to make a split-second decision. It was instinct. He sent you up as the sniper, Kara. He wants you dead. You knew too much.
You pretended to love me.
We've uncovered a plot by a Russian general, Koskov, to purchase American high-tech weapons.
What the hell are you trying to do, 007? Start World War III?
Pushkin is history.
Your James Bond hasn't laid a finger on him.
Okay, so it's 1986, and the last James Bond film was made about a year before. They weren't going to use Roger Moore again, because Roger Moore at the time was, you know, heading up towards 60 years old. The last few of them have been mocked for how old he was and the quality of the scripts and the quality of the movies themselves. The last one he did was A View to a Kill, the one with Christopher Walken and Grace Jones in it, so they needed to find a new James Bond, and of course that always generates a lot of media publicity when that occurs. They were looking at a bunch of people, including Sam Neill, the New Zealand actor, and a guy called Anthony Hamilton, who was an Australian actor, blonde, good-looking, things like that. They probably weren't going to use him anyway, even though he did look like he could handle himself well and would have made a bigger and more muscular Bond. One of the reasons predominantly would be that Mr. Hamilton was gay and unfortunately died of complications from AIDS in the 1990s. You might have seen him in the 1980s reboot of Mission Impossible that was filmed here in Australia. So they had to find a James Bond. And they ended up with Timothy Dalton, which was an interesting and slightly lateral choice. Dalton had done a bunch of TV. He'd done some movies as well. He was in Lion in Winter with Peter O'Toole and Catherine Hepburn, for instance. He was also he played Heathcliff in a remake of Wuthering Heights in 1970. And then he kind of concentrated on the theatre. He worked with the Royal Shakespeare Company for a time, so he wasn't really a bad actor at all. And he'd starred in a couple of other films, Mary Queen of Scots, he was in that as well, and a spy movie of no particular wonderfulness called Permission to Kill in 1975. The same year that he was in Sextet, which, if you're a fan of incredibly bad movies, that's the one to see, because he played Mae West's husband when she was 85 years old. It's an embarrassment for everybody who was in that film, and I've seen it once, and even I won't go there again. It's just atrociously bad. I had people like Ringo Starr in it, for instance, and a bunch of other people, and yeah, pretty shitty, really. So, you've got a guy who looks right for James Bond. He doesn't totally look dissimilar to Ian Fleming's Description of Bond. He looks a little bit like a young Hoagy Carmichael in some ways. He's got the right features for it. He's lean, which Bond was in the movies, in the books, and a bit perfect for the role. They were going to go with another guy too. I've forgotten about that. They were going to go with Pierce Brosnan, but there were a whole bunch of different problems with the TV studio that he was working for in America playing Remington Steele. They had a right to his contract for another 60 days if they chose to pick up the thing. And when the Bond people from Eon Films were sniffing around, they basically took up the option, and Brosnan had to wait his turn after Dalton finished. So you've got Timothy Dalton playing James Bond, and a very different character. The Bond films had kind of been diminished by the Roger Moore years in a lot of ways. They were really put down as second-rate crap. There were other films coming up that were much more exciting and much more vital and didn't basically turn their hero into a clown, which is one of the unfortunate things about the Roger Moore films. They really didn't have a James Bond that was recognisable from the books in any way possible. So Eon Films and the Broccolis and Michael Wilson decided that they were going to take things in a different direction, and so hence they were going to make The Living Daylights. There were other real-world issues coming up that changed the way that Bond had to be approached in the late 1980s. For instance, one of them was that the Soviet Union was stuck in this war in Afghanistan, and there were a few hints, not very many, and not everyone picked up on them, but there were a few hints that the Soviet Empire wasn't doing well and was making a lot of overtures to the West to be more friendly. So the old enmity between the West and the Soviet Union was greatly diminished by this stage. That was one of the two things that were affecting these things. The other thing was HIV, basically. AIDS came about, and that changed the way that people with non-monogamous sexual patterns were perceived, particularly in the media. At the time the movie was being made, Timothy Dalton was asked whether AIDS had any effect on the number of Bond girls that were going to be in The Living Daylights. And there were basically two, one very minor one and one predominant one in the movie. And he said no at the time. But later in 1997, after he'd finished his relationship with Eon Films, he admitted that that was one of the reasons why the Bond girls numerically were diminished, because there was that perception that putting it about a lot would spread a potentially terminal disease, and they didn't want to get into that muddy water, so they backed off on Bond's promiscuity to a big extent. And in a sense, you know, you can understand it under the spirit of the times, and also it makes The Living Daylights in particular a bit of a stronger film as well, which is not a bad thing given the run of the Roger Moore films. Basically, the Dalton Bond films were a retcon. They were taking Bond back to the Connery and possibly even the Lazenby James Bond to a certain extent, while being aware of the changes that had occurred in the decade and a half since Sean Connery had last played the role. So they've got it all set up. They've got Timothy Dalton, and they've got to find a plot. Now, the last thing they'd done in a Bond film was a plan by a mad, genetically engineered Nazi baby to flood Silicon Valley with nuclear weapons. They backed off from that kind of ludicrous, over-the-top, bombastic plotting to something a little more human scale, a little more real, a little more based in the politics of the world as it was at the time, hence this film. It starts out really good, and it introduces Dalton very, very interestingly with a training exercise by the 00s on Gibraltar, and there's some fantastic second unit work with, apart living aside the fact that they've got a stupid little bit at the start where M sets up his office inside a Hercules transport plane, just for the fact that they wanted to have a transition between M's office and the guys on the training exercise. It's a bit of a hangover from the stupidity of the Roger Moore era, but we'll allow them that one at the start. just to let things run. So three of the 00s parachute out to try to basically conquer Gibraltar and get to a certain objective on Gibraltar. All of the soldiers on Gibraltar are alerted and ready for the training exercise. They've got paintball guns to shoot them with should they find any of the 00s. And that's the setup. So they do a beautiful parachute jump onto Gibraltar with some fantastic second unit photography and aerial photography of the guys skydiving down on this enormous, great big finger of rock. But what they don't know is that there's also a Russian assassin waiting for them on the rock, ready to kill the 00s and blame it on Smerch Spionam. Smersh, which was an old Beria-era KGB operation to kill people like James Bond, to kill English agents. It was a real-life thing, too. It wasn't something that was made up by Ian Fleming for the books. Smerch Spionam was a real thing, but it had been cancelled in the 1950s when they found that all it did was really escalate the tit-for-tat killings, and so didn't get them what they were aiming for at the time. So you got basically two of the 00s get killed in interesting ways, and the third, and the guy then goes after 007, not successfully. This ends up in an enormous jeep chase through the hills and down into the non-military areas of Gibraltar, ending in a great big leap by a jeep off the side of Gibraltar, and Bond saving the day and landing on a yacht with a beautiful woman in a bikini on it, which is kind of a nice way to introduce things. And then you go into, of course, the Morris Binder titles and things like that. But it's a really nice setup. It's a tough sequence. It's done very well. There's a few jump scares in it, which it kind of work well using some of the local wildlife. And it works well to take Bond away from the ludicrousness of the Roger Moore Bond films. It does feel a lot more like an action film of the time than a Bond film in that initial sequence, which is good. It really does show that they didn't let go of all of the tropes that they had during the Moore years, but they were at least thinking about other ways of telling the story, which, you know, all credit to them for that. Eventually, they got it right with the Daniel Craig ones, but we'll leave that aside for one moment. So you've got Dalton firmly established as Bond, which is a good thing. Then you've got to go in and find the plot, which I kind of like in this one. Apart from the pre-title sequence, the movie starts basically following the short story of the Living Daylights, which appeared in a posthumous 1966 short story collection of Ian Fleming's called Octopussy and the Living Daylights. Basically, they're trying to smuggle someone out of East Germany, in this case a Russian general who's defecting, and they want to make sure that they hear there's a sniper who's going to try to pop the general as he's escaping, and Bond's job is to find the sniper from a vantage point overlooking the theatre where the general is attending a concert, and take out the sniper. That's the way it's set up. Bond is being helped by a British agent called Saunders, who's part of the local station, and who doesn't hide his disdain for which he holds the 00 section, and really is a little bit bureaucratic, but eventually comes around to seeing Bond's viewpoint. The twist of it is that the sniper turns out to be a cellist from the orchestra, a woman, because all of the best KGB snipers are women. Her name's Kara Milovi, and she's played by Mariam Dabo, an English actress. So rather than shooting her, Bond basically shoots the gun from her hand, gives her a little bit of a flesh wound, and much to Saunders' disgust, decides to do that rather than killing her. Saunders wants him to take her out because that's the orders. But Bond is very snappish and dismissive of that because he's seen the way she handles the gun and knows that she's not a professional sniper, she's somebody else. So Saunders' plan to get General Koskov, played by Jeroen Krabbe, the Dutch actor, out is to put him in the boot of the car and take him across Checkpoint Charlie. Bond knows this isn't going to work, and to be honest with you, it seems like a pretty lame plan. I think they might have thought up something somewhat better to give as the first plan for getting this Russian general out of the East. Instead, Bond finds another way to get him out, which I'm not going to spoil if you haven't seen the film, but it's a little bit of fun and shows just a touch of that comedy that we know from the Roger Moore James Bond films, but not in a heavy-handed way. And it's done a little bit better, I think, than a lot of the shit that happened during the Moore years. So Bond gets Koskov out and things move on from there. There's a little bit of a précis from Wikipedia, which is probably helpful at this stage. It goes into the start of the film, but I'll just read that out now. Here we are. Bond acts as a counter-sniper to protect the Soviet defector Yorgi Koskov. He tells Bond that General Pushkin, head of the KGB, is systematically killing British and American agents. When Koskov is seemingly snatched back, Bond follows him across Europe, Morocco, and Afghanistan. So that's basically the plot of it. So you've got General Pushkin, who is played by John Rhys-Davies, another Welshman just like Timothy Dalton is, who seems to have made a history of playing everything but Welshman, which is kind of interesting. He's even been in an episode of SpongeBob SquarePants, which shows that he's a versatile gentleman, if nothing else. And of course, he played one of Indiana Jones's mates, which is kind of interesting, because the second James Bond film we're going to talk about, License to Kill, went up against the third Indiana Jones film in the box office and wasn't successful because of that. So you've got that set up there. Of course, the lovely blonde cellist and Bond get together because they find out, oddly enough, that she is Koskov's girlfriend. And she's very much in love with him, whereas Koskov has his own agendas and really doesn't care about her at all. And that's one of the interesting subplots in this film, that kind of three-way relationship between Koskov, Bond, and Kara, in that Bond knows at some stage that her boyfriend and the man she loves has betrayed her and left her to be interrogated by the KGB and basically hold the bag for him after he ostensibly defects. There's an interesting thing there. It really is a little more complex emotionally than a lot of the stuff that came from the Roger Moore era. And, of course, Bond and her form a bond and escape from Bratislava, where she lives, across to Austria, and from there end up in Morocco trying to follow Koskov and find out what's really going on. In the meantime, Koskov does escape from British custody. He's in a safe house out in the country, a very elaborately posh safe house with a lot of guards in it, which I thought was a little bit unrealistic until I saw something online the other day about CIA safe houses in America. And they showed these enormous, they look like convalescent hospitals for rich people, which were at least one of the CIA safe houses. They were posh. They had beautiful gardens and areas like that. So this gets a little more credibility because of that. Safe houses for particularly high-profile defectors were very, very posh places at the time of the Cold War. But Koskov is implanted there. James Bond gets him a very nice picnic basket from Claridge's. And as Bond leaves, just after Bond leaves, Necros, one of the main bad guys, then basically invades the safe house disguised as a milkman and arranges for Koskov to be kidnapped again and taken back, but not to Russia. This brings us to one of the interesting aspects of Bond films. There's always a bunch of different kinds of villains in a James Bond film. First off, there's the main villain, the bad guy, your Blofelds, your people like that, your Goldfingers. And then you've got the secondary one who's not as smart. And then you've got the muscle. So there's usually three types. So the examples in this film are there's the smart bad guy in this case, who is Koskov and his people, who have got a deal with an arms dealer called Brad Whitaker, played by Joe Don Baker, to get advanced weapons for Russia and to finance this, they're smuggling opium out of Afghanistan. So they've got a little bit of a three-way trade there. So he's the kind of the smart villain in a sense. He's not very smart, though. This one of the problems with the Dalton films is the villains aren't very strong as they are in some of the other Bond films. Then you've got the dumb villain, who in this case will be somebody like Brad Whitaker, the gun supplier, played by Joe Don Baker, who later on went on to play a sidekick to Pierce Brosnan's James Bond, a guy called Jack Wade. He appeared in GoldenEye and also Tomorrow Never Dies. So you got your smart villain, you got your dumb villain, then you've got your muscle. In this case, the muscle is Necros, played by a former Olympic swimmer called Andreas Wisniewski, who's still acting, and he's kind of tall, blonde, muscular. In this movie, Necros is able to do a whole bunch of different accents. He's very good with accents. He can play Americans, he can play English people, he can play anything that's required of him. Though it's a very underwritten role, which is a bit of a shame, because Necros is the most interesting in some ways of the villains in this film. And yet, maybe because the actor playing him didn't have the chops, I don't know. But he was one of those villains that you want to see more of in the film, but unfortunately you don't get that opportunity. So anyway, Kara and Bond are kidnapped and taken to Afghanistan and locked up in a Russian military prison on a base in Afghanistan. They escape using one of Q's gadgets, which again is a little bit of a hangover from the Roger Moore era, but you know, they don't want to totally change things. They're a little uncertain of themselves in the franchise, and they don't want to kind of throw everything out, so they're not really letting go of a lot of the things that made people laugh in the previous movies. So they escape and hook up with the Mujahideen. And now this is another interesting part as well, because people talk about this film, they go, oh, look, James Bond was working with the Taliban, because the Mujahideen and the freedom fighters in Afghanistan are perceived to have become the Taliban. It's a little more complicated than that, and I've done my research on the Mujahideen. The Mujahideen were a loose alliance of tribes in Afghanistan and different interest groups who coordinated to fight against the Russian invasion of Afghanistan in the 1970s and 1980s. They were never a cohesive force at all. They were basically, there were sophisticated people from the cities in some groups. There were tribal people on horseback in other groups. They were a mixture of things. Only one of these groups went on to become the Taliban. The rest of them they killed out or were absorbed. But it was only one small group that became the Taliban. So it's a little unrealistic to say that James Bond was helping the Taliban. What he was helping was the Mujahideen. And the word Mujahideen is, very simply, it means strugglers. So you can find Mujahideen all the way across the Islamic world. There are Mujahideen working in the southern provinces of the Philippines at the moment. There are Mujahideen in Burma. There were Mujahideen in Burma. There were Mujahideen in Africa as well. It's basically people who are fighting against oppression from an Islamic viewpoint. That was what the word actually meant. Taliban, oddly enough, means student. So there you go. Every time you talk about the Taliban, what you're actually saying are students. Not really students, but that's what the word means anyway. So saying that James Bond was helping the Mujahideen and thereby helping the Taliban is a little too simplistic for the incredibly complex internal politics of these kind of groups at the time and as we have them now. So I'm going to say, and anyway, the guy they meet up with is a guy called Cameron Shah, who's a very charismatic leader played by Art Malik. And he was educated, he's English educated, so come the time of the Taliban's, his mob will be the first ones to be killed out because of the Western influences. Anyway, they hook up with them, Bond puts a bomb on an aeroplane full of opium that's about to be shipped to the West, and gets trapped on the plane himself. Now, there's a fantastic action sequence here with a cargo net full of opium hanging off the back of an aeroplane and two people fighting on that cargo net. Now, this isn't just done with rear projection in the Pinewood Studios. There were actually guys hanging off the back of a transport aeroplane on an enormous cargo net full of pouches of ostensibly opium, fighting off the end of a flying aeroplane. And it's a fantastic action sequence. There was nothing like it beforehand. And one of the things that Bond films pride themselves on is the second unit stunt work. And this really is top stuff. It's a really great looking sequence. A lot of it was filmed over the deserts in America, but some of it was filmed in Morocco. Morocco substituted for Afghanistan, even though the territories are totally unalike. I've flown across Iran and that part of the world in a plane once, and it's a lot different looking than it is in the Bond films. But we've got to allow them that, because you couldn't really fly over Afghanistan at the time because the Russians owned it. So, yeah, and basically, that's one side of the film, is all the action stuff and the betrayal. There's a little bit of a coda at the end where Bond confronts Whittaker, but that feels a little bit like a kind of Roger Moore action sequence. But the big action sequences in Afghanistan, or ostensibly in Afghanistan, are the fun ones. Now, there's another aspect to this film as well. It's probably the third most romantic James Bond film there is. First one, of course, being on Her Majesty's Secret Service, and the second one being Casino Royale. But this one really does have Bond as a romantic figure in it. The relationship between him and Cara really does play out well. I think there's a lot of charm in it. Dalton plays very well with Mariam Darbo, and there's a scene set in the Tivoli Ferris wheel. Yes, the same one that Harry Lime and Holly Martins were in The Third Man, which goes to really show that this is a different Bond than the Roger Moore one. Roger Moore never really had any passion and fire and depth of emotion with any of the female characters in his Bond films. But this one does show us again that Bond is somebody who does have deeper feelings and can be very human in places. And it's a refreshing thing after all of the Roger Moore ones, showing this guy as a human being and not just an angry, violent human being, but someone who does have emotions of the softer kind and does allow them to be a part of his life, which I really liked a lot. I think that showing us this character in this way is something that, of course, it had something to do with the AIDS thing and then taking things in a different direction from the polygamous James Bond of previous years. But it works, and John Barry's soundtrack, which you can hear in the background now, really does add to that as well. Dropping it to one side for a moment, the theme music in this is really lame. Getting a Norwegian pop group to do the theme for James Bond films is one of those stupid things that they've never done since then. The theme from Living Daylights by A-ha is just piss poor and ordinary. But the orchestral stuff by John Barry really does work well, and it's a nice little bow out for John Barry as a composer for James Bond films. He'd done 12 of them all up, and this was the very last one before, unfortunately, his health did deteriorate because of various issues, and he never again did music for a James Bond film, which is a bit of a shame because he's the one who really gives us the brass and strings that we know from a very strong James Bond soundtrack, and which again even you'll see echoes of in Skyfall, the music from Skyfall, for instance, which is a nice legacy to John Barry's contribution to the series. But apart from that, there's not too much else to say about this film. It does show a very sharp turn from the previous films in the series. It shows that Bond can adapt to new times and can be adapted if the producers are willing to take the risk, which they very much did in the Daniel Craig years, for instance, doing an entire retcon and rebooting James Bond from the start of his career onwards does work well. There's the old story, too, that one of the theories that people have of James Bond films is that James Bond is a job title and the different people in different eras take it on, which is kind of an interesting conceit, but retconning is something we've got to accept. You really can't have a Cold War character like Bond stay the same and still expect him to be valid to a modern audience. You've really got to reinvent him now and then to enhance the audience identification and to be able to tell modern stories using the James Bond template. And I think that The Living Daylights does do a good start to that. There are some great car chase sequences. There are some great characters in it, but the interesting characters are Bond, which is a nice change, and Kara. They're the two most interesting characters in the movie. Jerome Crabbe is kind of ordinary, playing General Koskov. John Rhys-Davies plays John Rhys-Davies to a certain extent. His girlfriend, by the way, or wife, whichever one it is, General Pushkin's wife, is played by an Australian actress, Virginia Hay, and she does have one extremely interesting distinction. She's the first woman to show a nipple in a James Bond film. It's a side-on view, but it's definitely a nipple there in a sequence in a hotel room. So I think there should be more of them, of course. I'm a great fan of nipples in cinema, particularly in James Bond films. I think that there are any number of James Bond films that may have been enhanced by a lot more nudity. But leaving that very masculine and very heterosexual aside, I think that this is the first point where they realise that they've really got to reinvent this character and to take him in new directions and not to rest on their laurels and not just to treat James Bond as a bit of a cartoon and a bit of a joke, but that they can make money. And this was very successful. It's a lot more successful than the last few Roger Moore movies. They can make money by giving us a more complicated Bond and a more up-to-the-date Bond. And this, of course, is where the legacy of the Daniel Craig years starts from. The Broccolis still run James Bond to a big extent, Eon Films and the Broccolis, and Michael G. Wilson still run James Bond. That continuity does work because they learn the lessons. The lesson they learned from License to Kill, which is a very important lesson that the Bond films have kept ever since then, is they were up against an Indiana Jones movie, the Tim Burton Batman film, Lethal Weapon 2, and a bunch of other films around the same time as they released License to Kill, which is one of the reasons why it wasn't successful. There was just too much in the market right at that time. Ever since then, James Bond films have always been released off-season, so that there's not too much standing in their way of the box office. And again, that's the kind of experience you get from having the same people and the same group of people doing things over a long period of time. You get that kind of insider and that special knowledge to be able to maximize the profits and the interest in the product that you're producing. So I'm going to take another break now, and then we're going to look at the second of the two Timothy Dalton James Bond films, License to Kill.
Wild is love. Whenever two hearts meet, wild is love. Bitter but oh so sweet. And I know I must go wherever love takes me. Whatever love makes me, I will be like a fire, burning beyond control. Wild is love, deep in my heart and soul. And though wild is the wind and wild is the roaring sea, nothing could ever be as wild as love. I know I must go wherever love takes me, whatever love makes
me, I will be. And though wild is the wind and wild is the roaring sea, nothing could ever be as wild as love, as wild as love, as wild as love, as wild as love.
That was Nat King Cole with the Nelson Riddle Orchestra and Wild is Love from his 1960 album titled Wild is Love. So on to License to Kill. This is a movie that came out around the same time as Die Hard. Really is in that feeling of late 1980s action films. It's got a few 1980s action film kind of people in it too, people we know from cult movies and other things. It's got Robert Davi playing the main villain of the piece. It's got Benicio del Toro as a 21-year-old playing a villain. It's also got Grandel Bush and a bunch of other people you'll know from various movies, and Frank McRae, who was known for playing curmudgeonly police chiefs in a bunch of films as well. You have David Hedison coming back from his stint with Roger Moore playing Felix Leiter, and his bride, played by Priscilla Barnes, who herself has been in a number of interesting cult films as well. Then you've got the Bond women in it. You've got Carrie Lowell playing Pam Bouvier and Talisa Soto, who was an actor who didn't get a hell of a lot of roles, but she did end up marrying the actor Benjamin Bratt, and they've lived happily ever after. She, in this particular movie, played Lupi Lamora, a South American woman with whom Bond has something of a liaison. Now, at the time, the producers of the film wanted to make a James Bond film in China with chase scenes on the Great Wall and fights among the porcelain warriors, terracotta warriors in China. But the Last Emperor had just come out, and they thought, nah, the Last Emperor's done China, so we won't do China. And instead, they looked at South America and the South American drug trade in particular for the inspiration. Now, this also has a few scenes which owe a lot to some scenes in a couple of the James Bond novels. I'll go into the plot first, and then I'll talk about that. It's probably the fairest way to go. But before I do that, there is a nice little quote I've got here from Timothy Dalton about playing Bond in the James Bond films. He was interviewed in 1989 and said this: "I think Roger was fine as Bond, but the films had become too much technopop and had lost track of their sense of story. I mean, every film seemed to have a villain who had to rule or destroy the world. If you want to believe in the fantasy on screen, then you have to believe in the characters and use them as a stepping stone to lead you into this fantasy world. That's a demand I made, and Albert Broccoli agreed with me." So there you go. He wanted to first character, then plot and story, which is an actor's way of looking at it, particularly somebody who'd worked with the Royal Shakespeare Company. Of course, the character is all. But it's interesting to see that that was his emphasis and the way he brought things into it. And we see that at the start of License to Kill as well. You see James Bond doing a very prosaic kind of thing. He's best man at Felix Leiter's wedding. Felix is going to marry the love of his life, played by Priscilla Barnes. They get sidelined as because Felix is now a drug enforcement agent, and he is after a big drug lord called Sanchez, played by Robert Davi, and they go, and there's a beautiful scene over the Florida Keys where they basically grab the light plane that Sanchez is in. There's a bit of a gunfight on the ground. And then Bond does one of those great aerial stunts that Bond does, where he climbs out of a rescue helicopter with a winch, ties the winch to the back of the light plane's tail, and they just basically drag it back to where they want it to be. Beautiful bit of stunt work too, because it's all done live. So there was a stuntman hanging out on out of a back of a helicopter, landing on the back of a light plane, tying a winch around it, and then parachuting off that to land at the wedding reception, which is kind of cool. But it, the interesting thing it does show is Bond doing something very mundane and ordinary and showing him connected to the world in a way that we hadn't previously seen before, except in perhaps on Her Majesty's Secret Service. You hadn't seen Bond in a real-life situation of that kind before, apart from his own wedding in On Her Majesty's Secret Service. And unfortunately, Felix's wedding ends up pretty much the same, because to borrow a scene from Live and Let Die, Felix gets chewed on by a shark. The bad guys dangle him into a shark tank. He loses a leg and possible use of an arm, and his bride is raped and killed by Sanchez's men. Now, that's shown pretty much off-screen, the rape and the murder of the bride, but still, in spite of that, it is something that's a bit harsher than we've previously seen in a James Bond film. There's that, yeah, there's a lot at stake here. And this then makes it very much a personal vendetta for Bond, and he goes rogue. Hence, the original title of the film was going to be License Revoked, but they decided that Americans wouldn't know what revoked meant, which I think is kind of a little bit odd, but that's how it goes. And by the way, I should name check the bride of Felix Leiter as well, because it's only fair that each character has his name, whether it's a male or a female character. And her name in the film is, he said, looking it up, Della. Then, of course, you've got, looking at the movie, and it just occurred to me that the only reason Della exists as a character is so that she could be raped and killed and therefore let James Bond go rogue and retire from the Secret Service and go after Sanchez in an incredible rampage that ends up with trucks throwing wheelies, lots and lots of violence, Wayne Newton running away from an explosion, and a bunch of other stuff. Oh yes, Wayne Newton's in this movie as well, playing Joe Butcher, a televangelist who is part of the communication network for Sanchez's drug trade. Now, is a little bit weak in some ways, because God is never mentioned in this televangelist thing. It's almost like he's a New Age freaky kind of guy rather than a televangelist. But at the time, there were a lot of televangelist scandals and things like that. So it was a very topical thing to do, and Wayne Newton wanted to be in a James Bond film, so they did that. Basically, his character serves no real purpose apart from getting Wayne Newton into a James Bond film. Having said that, it is quite an exciting movie. I mean, they got the pre-title sequence with the capture of Sanchez, then you've got Sanchez's escape, then you've got the betrayal of Felix Leiter by another DEA agent played by Everett Gill, who you might remember from things like Twin Peaks and a bunch of other films as well. You have Bond's confrontation with M at Ernest Hemingway's house on the Florida Keys. I'm not sure why, apart from the fact that it's Ernest Hemingway's house, and they wanted to throw in a gratuitous wry comment about an Ernest Hemingway novel. But, yeah, it's in there, and Bond goes undercover, infiltrates Isthmus City, the city where Sanchez has his headquarters, meets Lupe, gets involved with Pam Bouvier, who is a CIA agent and a plane pilot. Now, played by Kerry Lowell, Pam Bouvier is one of those James Bond film feminists who does lip service to things and calls him a sexist pig, but doesn't, and she's very competent in her own way, but it's a very kind of soft kind of feminism in a way, and all it does is serves to show that James Bond is right about a number of things and she's wrong about them. So it's weak writing in that way. Whereas in more recent James Bond films, I think the women have got a better deal to them than they have in the past, and there's at least an attempt to give them more fully fleshed out characters, for instance, than they have. One of the problems you've got with the earlier James Bond films, in a lot of cases, with a few exceptions, there are a few exceptions like Honey Rider and Dr. No, and a few others, is that the female characters are incredibly lightly written. There's not a lot of thought gone into the writing of them, which is strange because Fleming himself did write complex female characters, but they hadn't until very, very recently translated well to the screen, because the movies have developed into a franchise which is more guy-oriented than woman-oriented, so women's emotions wasn't perceived as being important. Whereas as soon as Casino Royale came out and they had the complex characters, for instance, of Vespa, you don't really have that previously in a Bond film, and maybe Tracy Vincenzo in On Her Majesty's Secret Service. You don't have complex human beings in the female characters, which is kind of a, to be honest with you, it's a missed opportunity, I think, looking back at it from retrospect now. At the time, I didn't care because I was young and stupid. But the complex characters, and particularly complex female characters, really enhance a James Bond film. They just turn it from two-dimensional to something a little closer to three-dimensional, which is kind of something that I look forward to now in the Bond films, to see how they handle women and the backstories they give them. And given that the times now, we've got a real emphasis on what women want and how they perceive themselves and how masculinity is also being redefined by the changes in our society, it looks to be an interesting time for a character like Bond in the future. They could either kind of go misogynistic bastard, or they can allow him I've got a lot of goodwill towards James Bond as a character, and what I'm trying to say is I think that he deserves better than he's got in the past. And even though Dalton does a terrific job of giving us a new Bond and giving us a more complex Bond, and one who has put up with a lot in his life and has been through immense traumas, and at some level you can be perceived, particularly if you read the books, that Bond himself suffers from PTSD, particularly as you head towards the later books like You Only Live Twice. Bond is a man who is burning out, and that's an interesting Bond for a movie to play. And there's a little bit of that in what we see in License to Kill. He's willing to give up his career to go on this vendetta to avenge Della and Felix, and he's willing to risk everything for it. And that's a very obsessive thing, of course, but it's also a Bond that's very distant from the detached, wry, funny, doesn't really give a shit Bond that we had in Roger Moore. And a lot of that strength is, of course, Timothy Dalton's, and we can't ignore that. Benicio del Toro is a very interesting thing. Even though all he gets to do is wield a knife, pretty much, and giggle, he's got that weird look about him and teeth like mismatched Mahjong tiles. And, he kind of doesn't have a lot of scenes in this film, but the ones he does have are interesting, particularly when Bond's hanging above a crushing machine and he goes down to cut him loose with a knife. He actually cut Timothy Dalton's hand doing that scene, Del Toro did, and he was very apologetic about it, and they had to stop filming for a few days while Dalton's hand healed. But it's, the movie is a little bit all over the place. It's got a lot of things that are done just to set up action scenes, and it's done a little bit more obviously than it should be, I think. But given that action scenes are what we go to Bond movies for, I think the establishment of them becomes increasingly important, and particularly looking back on them, we can see where things are done purely to enable another action scene to occur. But having said that, there's some very good action scenes in this film as well. René Julien, the French guy who is the guy to go to for car action scenes at this time, for instance, he did the stuff in The Italian Job and a bunch of other films, right up to and including Ronin, the Robert De Niro film of about a decade and a half ago. They do some things with trucks that you've never seen before, getting a truck to do a wheelie, for instance, and getting one to tip on its side onto two wheels to avoid a Stinger missile, which was actually done by the driver. It wasn't anything that was rigged up with cables or anything like that. The driver actually tipped the truck and held it on the two wheels, or the wheels all along one side, really is an impressive bit of stunt work. And Q gets a look, and Desmond Llewellyn playing Q gets a little bit of an extended role in this film and proves himself to be an interesting little addition to it and a bit of comic relief. People have criticised this film for not having enough humour in it because I think they were pretty much programmed to a different kind of Bond film by the previous ones in the series. But Desmond Llewellyn's in there and does lighten things up a little bit. Kerry Lowell and Talisa Soto aren't very strong as the Bond women. I don't know whether that's to do with their acting or to do with that previously mentioned lightness of the characterizations, but I think that you do need stronger women in a Bond movie too. You've got to give people a reason to accept that Bond finds them attractive beyond the fact that they're eye candy. And I think that this movie just simply doesn't do that. There are some great locations around Acapulco in particular, which are quite lovely, and around Key West. Problem with it is, I think, that one of the things with location shooting, particularly in a movie of this kind and a movie with this level of complexity, is you need to have a bit more contour to the locations, because you've got Florida Keys and the Bahamas, which are pretty much flat, little flat areas with lots of beautiful ocean around them. Then you've got the scenes in Acapulco and on the hills around it. There's not really that sense of place that a really good James Bond film brings to the locations. They did go light on this one because of the finances at the studio, and that kind of limited their ability to do certain things. But in spite of that, it's a lot better than a lot of the previous 10 years of James Bond movies is. Robert Davi is okay as Sanchez, though he doesn't really have that operatic grandeur that you get from a really top James Bond film, Javier Bardem being the most recent example of that. And one of the other things you've got to have with a good Bond villain, in my opinion, is they've got to have some kind of physical deformity, because that's what Fleming did. All of them were weird in some way. And that is almost a hallmark of the main villain in a James Bond film. They've got to have something that makes you go, ugh, just by looking at them. Mads Mikkelsen with the bleeding eye, for instance, in Casino Royale worked really well. And, of course, there is Silver's problems with Javier Bardem in Skyfall. Yeah, I think that those kind of things we expect from a Bond film, and they're things that can be adapted to a whole bunch of different circumstances. You could have had a monstrously ugly, or, you know, basically you can have that Bond villain with the ickiness factor anywhere from Dr. No right up until now. It really is something that isn't going to fade with time. It's a universal in a Bond film. It's a bit like having the gun barrel at the start. It's something that you can have as a little linchpin there and something to help with audience appreciation of the movie a lot more than having somebody who's like a generic Miami Vice drug lord, which is pretty much the way Robert Davi plays Sanchez. Now, then you've got Milton Kress, who was actually a character in a James Bond short story called The Hildebrand Rarity. That was for one of the short story collections that Ian Fleming did. Played by Anthony Zerbe, who was very good in The Amiga Man, for instance, was also in Will Penny with Charlton Heston, the Tom Grice-directed movie, which is one of my favourite westerns. But in this one, he's not really outstandingly good in it. Del Toro, of the villains, is probably the most interesting one, and he doesn't get anywhere near enough screen time. But having said that, the action sequences are good. Dalton is good, given what he has to work with in the movie. You got Wayne Newton in there for no good reason. I keep expecting him to burst out into Donkershane at some stage, but he never does. The soundtrack is by Eric Carmen, and the Gladys Knight theme song isn't very good. I think the music is amongst the weakest in the series up to that point, which is a little bit of a shame. And the music that is there is kind of dated very badly, along with a number of other ones, but there are some that don't date. But this, John Barry at the time was quite ill, so he was going to originally do the music for this movie, but couldn't take up that opportunity, unfortunately. So just to really summarise these two films, Dalton is very good. I think there are some lessons learned from the making of these two films that were later on used to rejuvenate and to retcon the series. The Pierce Brosnan ones, I liked at the time, which is really odd, but I've rewatched them in the last couple of years and they have diminished, maybe because of the Daniel Craig stuff, but they really do seem like they're, at least in a partial sense, a slight return to the Roger Moore stuff in some ways. There are a couple of very gritty scenes in a couple of them, but not nearly enough to justify them being raised above, say, Timothy Dalton or even George Lazenby, who did a good job given his limited training and the circumstances of making the film, the fact that he was given very bad advice by his agent not to sign up for a three-picture deal. So, yeah, I think Timothy Dalton is that kind of turning point and that tipping point in the franchise toward something that guarantees the longevity of James Bond movie series. I think that he should be highly regarded for that. And if you haven't seen him in Penny Dreadful, the new TV series, steampunky kind of League of Extraordinary Gentlemen type TV series, you really should. I think he does sterling work in that. And Eva Green's in there as well, and she's very, very good in it as well. So I'm going to take another break now, and then when I get back, it's going to be time for some feedback.
Midnight, one more night without sleeping, watching till the morning comes creeping. Green door, what's that secret you're keeping?
There's an old piano and they play it hot behind the green door. Don't know what they're doing, but they laugh a lot behind the green door. Wish they let me in so I could find out what's behind the green door.
Not once tried to tell them I've been there. Door slam, hospitality's thin there. Wonder just what's going on in there.
Saw an eyeball peeping through a smoky cloud behind the green door. When I said Joe sent me, someone laughed out loud behind the green door. All I want to do is join the happy crowd behind the green door.
Sleeping, watching till the morning comes creeping. Green door, what's that secret you're keeping? Green door, what's that secret you're keeping? Green door.
That was Jim Lowe with Green Door. And here we go with the feedback. The first one I got is from David Dayett, who says, Aldo Ray, you might have given him short shrift. Have you seen Nightfall? I thought he was pretty good in that. Keep up the fantastic and fun work. I haven't seen Nightfall, but I've just added it to my download list from CinemaGen. So I should be able to have a slightly more nuanced view on Aldo Ray in future based on it, and I'll let you know how it goes. So I've got that, and I've also received a voicemail which was emailed to me. As I said previously, the voicemail phone number is no longer functioning because they were just too much hassle, but I'm always willing to accept MP3s, or even if you want to, I can get it off. If you've got a Google Drive or something you want to share some kind of cloud storage with me, if you set up a folder and want to share it with me so I can download it, I'm more than happy to take that as well. I've got one for Richard Palmer, but Richard also sent a little bit of an email with it saying, Terry, an interesting gambit asking a question to inspire feedback. I like it. I kept the MP3 attached shortish and a bit capsulated. You wouldn't necessarily need to use it quickly. Hope your winter is light. My spring has brought violent storms. Global warming is a bitch. I agree, because we've had unseasonably warm winter weather up until the last few days, and after which it suddenly got rainy and not too pleasant. Here's Richard's voicemail.
Hello, Terry. This is Rich Palmer of the Rotcast Podcast. I haven't put up a show in such a long time, but your two shows are always an inspiration, and you've made me drag out my digital recorder to answer the question you posed in your Pat and Mike episode. The question was, what classic movie star is just not that appealing? To me, the answer would have to be Betty Davis. I know she has legions of fans. They even wrote a song about her eyes, for God's sake. But I just never appreciated her work, and it's too late to start now. I did watch her in one movie, and it works well with your Pat and Mike theme. I was a big James Cagney fan, and I've tried to see all his movies. He was in a film with Betty Davis called The Bride Came COD. It was a comedy. I think the idea was to create a new classic romantic couple by pairing these two. It makes sense. They seem to be an odd couple, as his persona was a street tough who might tap dance while gunning you down, and she was usually the superior woman in all ways. But I can't remember a thing about that movie, and they never tried to pair them again, so maybe it wasn't a great idea. I know that Betty Davis is always in the top 10 of the greatest of American film actresses, but I just don't care.
Hi, Richard. That's definitely a valid choice, though. I like Betty Davis a little more than you do, probably for her more atypical roles, things like All About Eve, I like her for. And in Madam Sin with Robert Wagner, where Robert Wagner gets to say, "You're not a woman, you're a disease," in a really kind of snarly voice. That sounded more like Aldo Ray, come to think of it. But, so that's a valid one. I've got to think up a new question for this time around, too. Let me just cogitate on that and maybe get a little glass of Frangelico to inspire me. Okay, the Frangelico's inspired me. Here's the question. Which classic film that everybody likes have you either not seen or not liked? For me, I've never seen Gone with the Wind all the way through. I know that I should, just to evaluate it. But I've never actually bothered because Vivien Leigh in it seems to be incredibly annoying from the little bits I've seen. At some stage, I will see it. But, and if people want to start a Kickstarter to give me like $10 million to see the movie, I'll do it. But I've really got so many other things to watch. I'm really not going to be fucked watching Gone with the Wind at this stage. But let me know which ones you really want to see, but you've never have seen. Or alternately, which ones do you really put you off and you're never going to actually look at? I've been trying to get We've been together nearly 14 years now. We're trying to get Sal to watch Casablanca since Jesus was playing Cowboys and Indians. But she hasn't seen it yet, even though we have been in the fake Rick's Cafe Americana movie world in Queensland. She still hasn't seen Casablanca, and I wanted to see it. I think it's a great movie. I enjoyed it a lot. I've talked about it on a podcast, but she won't see it. So what is your classic movie that you either haven't seen or really can't be fucked seeing? So send a reply, cockguru@gmail.com is a big one, or the Paleo Cinema Cafe at Facebook. Either way, I'd be very happy to receive that. Now I've got a final track to play before we go, and this one's for Rich Palmer. But before I do, everyone take care of yourselves, enjoy the next 2 weeks of your lives, watch some good films, watch some bad films, watch them in company, watch them by yourselves, watch them intensely, watch them casually while you're doing other things, but watch them regardless. And I'll be back in 2 weeks with another Paleo Cinema podcast. See you then.
You marched away and left this town as empty as can be. And I am like the driftwood in a deadly calm at sea. I can't sit under the apple tree with anyone else but me. For there is no secret lover that the draft board didn't discover. They're either too young or too old. They're either too gray or too grassy green. The pickings are poor and the crop is lean. What's good is in the army. What's left will never harm me. They're either too old or too young. So, darling, you'll never get stung. Tomorrow I'll go hiking with that Eagle Scout, unless I get a call from Grandpa for a snappy game of chess. I'm finding it easy to stay good as gold. They're either too young or too old. They're either too warm or too cold. They're either too fast or too fast asleep. So, darling, believe me, I'm yours to keep. There isn't any gravy. The gravy's in the navy. They're either too fresh or too stale. There is no available mail. I will confess to one romance, I'm sure you will allow. He tries to serenade me, but his voice is changing now. I'm finding it easy to keep things controlled. They're either too young or too old. They're either too bald or too bold. I'm down to the wheelchair and bassinet. My heart just refuses to get upset. I simply can't compel it to, with no Marines to tell it to. I'm either their first breath of spring, or else I'm their last little fling. I either get a fossil or an adolescent pup. I either have to hold him off or have to hold him up. The battle is on, but the fortress will hold. They're either too young or too old. I'll never, never fail you when you are in Australia or out in the Aleutians or off among the Russians and flying over Egypt. Your heart will never be gypped. And when you get to India, I'll still be what I've been, dear. I've looked the field over, and lo and behold, they're either too young.